Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York and Colorado Public Radio, this is Ask a Legal State, a national conversation about pot. I'm Brian Lehrer from WNYC, along with Anne-Marie Awad from Colorado Public Radio and host of their new podcast about legal cannabis called On Something. Today is April 20th, 420, which we acknowledge is a thing in cannabis culture, originating among some high school students in Marin County, California, San Rafael High School, in 1971, as we understand it, 420 being the time of day after school and extracurricular activities when they would meet to smoke pot.
It's one of those times where the theories are way more interesting than the truth. That's right. But this hour is not for 420 jokes or stories about your best high or worst stoned and paranoid moment. Rather, it is for a journalistic conversation designed to connect people in legal weed states with people from other states like New York, as well as New Jersey, Illinois, and others who are actively considering legalization. Does the experience of legal states suggest it's a good idea? And if so, with what best practices to maximize social justice and public health? Later this hour, we will talk to the president and CEO of the NAACP, Derek Johnson. Interestingly, the NAACP is on different sides of the legalization question, depending on the state. But first, pot and public health. Our guest for this is Mark Kleinman, professor of public policy at New York University and author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's also a consultant to the state of Washington on its legalization process. Mark, thanks for lending us your expertise for this.
Always a pleasure to be on.
And listeners, our phones are open nationwide on Ask a Legal State. If you live in a legal state and have an observation about legal weed and public health and safety in the legal era, call in and share it. Our phone number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. And if you live in a non-legal state and you have a question about cannabis and public health, well, that's why we're here. Call in and Ask a Legal State, as the name of the program goes. The number again, 844-745-TALK, 844-745-8255. And we also have a hashtag if you want to write a question via Twitter. The hashtag is WeedToKnow, hashtag WeedToKnow. Mark, I think there are two main questions that most people have, so I'm just going to go right there. Are there more car crashes? Are there more people becoming cannabis dependent? Those are the two. And I guess there's a third, which is, are more people experiencing psychosis or other mental illness effects? Let's do car crashes first. Are there good stats?
There aren't. And let me just preface all of this. None of these questions is going to have an answer based on the experience of the early legalizing states.
Really? It's been 5 years in Colorado, et cetera?
The problem is it's been more than 5 years, because the early legalizing states were all wide open medical marijuana states. And when you look at the numbers, the shock to consumption levels comes in 2009 when the quasi-medical stores open, not in 2013, 2014, 2015, when the, quote, recreational stores open. Anybody in Colorado or Washington or California who wanted access to legally sold weed had it, because either you got a card from your doctor or from some doctor, or you had a friend who did.
But that would indicate that the amount of use of marijuana under recreational legalization in the early states is not more. If you can't measure an increase in car crashes, if there is one, because it was so readily available anyway under a very loosey-goosey medical marijuana system, which is, I think, what you just described, then you can't even figure out whether legalization for recreational use increases use itself?
That's right. And that's partly because even in the early legalizing states, we're nowhere near down to the equilibrium price. Oregon is the picture of the future, with ounces going for $40. That's $1.50 a gram.
Cheap.
Compared to illicit market prices of $10 to $15 a gram. Even Washington, Colorado are now only down to about 6 or 7. So there's a long way to go.
Sorry, let me understand what you're saying. Are you saying it's still more expensive than the black market, or you're saying prices are getting really cheap?
It's cheaper than the black market, but it's not as cheap as it's going to be.
Okay.
It's sometimes what's called a Russian average. Not as good as last year, but better than next year.
But let me press you on this.
We're not at the end yet.
But let me press you on this point a little bit. Are there no states with enough experience yet that were not loosey-goosey medical marijuana states? Like, for example, where we are, the New York, New Jersey area, where both states are seriously considering legalizing recreational adult use, they are not loosey-goosey medical
Correct.
Marijuana states. So are there no others with some experience yet that would allow you to say, okay, now that it's legal all of a sudden for recreational use, car crashes are going up or not going up?
That's right, there aren't. All of the early legalizing states were loosey-goosey states. So that means that their experience doesn't tell us about the potential New York experience. And even their experience now doesn't tell us about their experience 5 years from now. So lots of people saying, well, you know, car crashes haven't gone up. Youth use hasn't gone up. Cannabis use disorder hasn't gone up. We're fine. And I'm reminded of the guy who jumped off the observation deck of the Empire State Building. And as he passed the 42nd floor on the way down, somebody yelled out the window, "How's it going?" And he yells back, "So far, so good." We haven't crashed yet. We don't know much. I'm not very worried about car crashes. Stone driving is a very bad idea, and people do a lot too much of it. But it's a very bad idea the way talking to your companion in the car while you're driving is a bad idea. It's actually a less bad idea than talking on your legal hands-free cell phone. Relative risk, the increased probability of a crash, is about 2, which is a lot in epidemiological terms. But if you consider how safe driving is in general, twice that risk isn't very risky. So one way to think about it is driving 10 miles stoned is about as dangerous as driving 20 miles straight. It's not like alcohol. Relative risk of alcohol at a 0.1 BAC is 15. At a 0.15 BAC, which is pretty common, it's 30. And so we shouldn't apply to cannabis the rules we've developed for alcohol.
Now you're getting to something really substantive and really probably touchy, because you said before, it is not a good idea to drive stoned.
Right.
And we don't want to leave any ambiguity about that on this show. But you're also saying it's not nearly as dangerous as driving drunk.
Right. And if I got to make the laws, it would be a very high fine, high points traffic ticket.
Anne Marie.
I'm really interested. I mean, have you seen any state kind of figure out a good model for measuring intoxication when it comes to people who are driving? I mean, we struggle with this a lot in Colorado.
Yeah.
Like, I can give you stats with the caveat that, you know, it's what we measure for is not a guarantee that people are intoxicated.
Right. And that's the other problem. With alcohol, we have the breathalyzer, which is a very good proxy for alcohol in blood. Alcohol in blood is a very good proxy for alcohol in brain. Alcohol in brain is a very good proxy for impairment. None of that's true for cannabis. And most of the tests that get reported on measure both active THC and the inactive metabolites. So you know that the guy smoked sometime in the last 2 weeks, and you know very little else. The other thing we know from the national surveys is that of the heavy users, and they're the big problem here, 3/4 of them report that the last time they smoked weed, they also drank. So asking what the risk of cannabis isn't quite right. You have to ask what the risk of cannabis plus alcohol is. And I think there's evidence, though there's some dispute about this, that it's more than additively bad. So again, my law would be, if I got to be the dictator, that if you have a positive cheek swab for cannabis, which says you've used in the last 3 or 4 hours, and your BAC isn't 0, then you're driving drunk.
Victor in Buffalo Grove, Illinois. You're on Ask a Legal State. Hi, Victor.
Hi, my name is Victor. I'm from Illinois. So obviously Illinois has not legalized marijuana, but I'm just wondering, as a youth, what would be one of the biggest challenges that face youth after legalizing marijuana in terms of public health?
It partly depends on the policies. My view is that if the policies keep the prices high, as they have, for example, in the Netherlands, you can reconcile legal cannabis with no substantial increase in youth consumption. If the prices fall as far as they have in Oregon, I think it's very unlikely that that's not going to seriously impact the number of kids who use. And we know that early initiation to cannabis before age 16 is at least associated with some very bad outcomes. So I do think that keeping at least sort of middle school kids away from cannabis is a major objective.
Sarah in Ocean Township, New Jersey. You're on Ask a Legal State. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to try to make this quick. My family lost 4 months out of our lives last year. We found out that my 23-year-old daughter had been using marijuana for the first time. She had apparently vaped wax, which is a very high THC potency form of marijuana. She was hospitalized. The people in the hospital didn't know what was wrong with her. They were suspecting that there was some psychotic history in my family, which there isn't. She lost time from her job. I lost time from my job. I'm told that this type of marijuana is also available at very high potencies from dispensaries. So I'm wondering, in states where marijuana is legal, if you have seen an increase in psychotic episodes, and if so, is there any sort of public awareness outreach to let people know that marijuana is not necessarily this benign drug that people seem to think it is, but that it can have really serious repercussions for people in terms of, you know, psychosis and things like that.
Mark,
so
take that?
Several things to unpack there. Solid concentrates typically aren't vaped. They're using a form called dabbing, which is flash vaporizing a whole chunk of the stuff and breathing in it at once. It's certainly the most dangerous way to use cannabis products. And unfortunately, in Washington State, it's the fastest rising share of the market.
Same here in Colorado.
If I got to be the dictator, I would simply ban solid concentrates. I see no good use for them. Even the high potency liquids, if they're just vaped, probably no more dangerous than herbal cannabis. But the huge bolus of psychoactive you get by dabbing is just not a good idea. We don't have data on psychotic episodes, which is to be distinguished from psychosis as a diagnosis. About a quarter of the population will experience a psychotic episode at some time in their lives. Actual psychosis is much rarer than that. And we don't know anything definitive about whether cannabis can actually trigger long-term psychosis. Everybody believes that people with personal histories or family histories of schizophrenia should stay away.
We'll continue in a minute on Ask a Legal State.
One toll over the line, sweet Jesus. One toll over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station. One toll over the line. Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary.
From WNYC in New York and Colorado Public Radio, this is Ask a Legal State, a national conversation about pot. I'm Brian Lehrer from WNYC, along with Anne Marie Awad from Colorado Public Radio and host of their new podcast about legal cannabis called On Something. In this segment, we're talking about pot and public health, and our guest for this is Mark Kleiman, professor of public policy at New York University and author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. He was also a consultant to the state of Washington in its legalization process.
And we've been talking about the public health risks, but what about the public health benefits? And I don't mean from medical marijuana. I'll assume people are getting health benefits from it if they are taking it as a medicine. This program is really about recreational legalization. So can we start with fewer people, especially poor people of color, going to jail and maybe the public health impact of that?
Jail is certainly a very unhealthy environment. And as President Jimmy Carter said 40 years ago, the penalty for an activity shouldn't be more damaging than the activity itself. So getting rid of the arrests is a great idea. There's some new research coming out showing that adult use recreational legalization doesn't have the same impact on arrests of minors as full across-the-board decriminalization. So that's a deficiency in some of the current legalizing statutes. You're still having minors arrested for underage possession, again, by analogy with alcohol, and it's a very bad analogy. So I think we need to get rid of that. But certainly fewer adults wind up going to jail, and that's not going to jail is a healthy activity. There's some hope that the regulations about pesticide content will reduce some of the health damage. I'm not sure we've seen that yet because we don't know what pesticides to control. The big challenge is what to do about cannabis use disorder. The number one health risk of cannabis is getting stuck on cannabis. And it happens
dependency.
To
dependency. Dependency?
Dependency, what's now called substance use disorder. It's not an uncommon diagnosis. So about 40% of all the people who say on a survey that they used in the last month now say they used 25 days or more in the last month. So those are the daily, near daily smokers. That 40% is up from 11% in 1992. So there are a lot more heavy users. When you survey them, they report using an average of 1.5 grams a day. That's about four joints worth every day they use. So these are not puff at bedtime folks. These are heavy users. Of them, about a third to 40% meet the diagnostic criteria for cannabis use disorder by their own self-report. So that's, call it 40% of 40%, 16% of 25 million monthly smokers now have a diagnosable problem with cannabis. That's not a small problem.
Anne-Marie, how's that playing out in Colorado? And is it making any people regret the decision to legalize?
You have to admit that I don't have stats on that. I will say that a lot of what I hear as a reporter, and this isn't necessarily a use disorder when it comes to cannabis, but I hear a lot of people posing legalization as a solution to another problem of addiction, which is the opioid epidemic. And Mark, I'm really interested to hear whether or not you see any evidence that that would make a difference.
I think the best evidence we have is that it would make a difference, but not a big difference. It's clear that there are fewer opioid prescriptions and fewer opioid overdoses in states that legalize cannabis, whether for medical or recreational use. And that may be people substituting cannabis for opioids in pain relief. It may be people using cannabis with opioids and taking a smaller dose of opioids. Or it may be recreational substitution. I don't have a clue about that. And the effect is large enough to be convincing to me and to some other researchers, not large enough to be convincing to everybody. Keith Humphreys is still skeptical. And so not large enough to be a big difference, but a worthwhile difference. The huge disappointment is that on current evidence, cannabis is not a substitute for alcohol. I was sure it was going to be a substitute for alcohol, and that made me a strong advocate of legalization, because if you can get people off booze onto cannabis, you're way ahead. It just isn't. The heavy smokers are also drinkers. And
how about it as a gateway drug? That's another question that always comes up.
And never been.
I'm afraid you're going to tell me that there's not enough experience yet in the legal states to know if there's more opioid use as a result of more cannabis use.
Right. So let me back up for 1 second. There's not experience in the legal states. But remember, all those statistics I just cited weren't about legal states. Those were national statistics, and they're not specific to the legal states. I think the argument about legalization has been completely misframed. So people saying either cannabis is harmless, we should legalize it, or people saying cannabis is harmful, we should keep it illegal. My view is that we can probably do a better job of controlling it if it's legal nationally than we can by this insane process of state-by-state legalization. I don't think effectively prohibiting cannabis is a live option anymore. We're simply not up for the level of enforcement activity that we would be required to control a $50 billion a year illicit market. And so far, legal availability has not been a very great supply shock, at least compared to medical availability. But as the price continues to drift down, I think we're going to very likely to get some very bad results.
Bad results meaning?
Meaning more people with cannabis problems, more kids starting early. And if the minors start using more, which hasn't happened much, most of the increases have been among post 25 adults. What's happening? People aren't aging out of cannabis use anymore. But cannabis use by minors looks to me like has big educational impacts. And that worries me a lot. There's a good study from the Netherlands suggesting that cannabis availability leads to poor academic performance among university students. Hmm. Now take it to middle school. Not a good picture.
Let's take another phone call. Here's Nalto in Kennebunkport, Maine. Nalto, you're on Ask a Legal State. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm 68 years old, and I've waited all my life for this moment of potential national legalization. So I am a supporter of that from that aspect. However, I have been in renewable energy business since 1975. And because of my legalization interest in Maine, I started doing a little bit of study on how much power, electrical power, indoor growing operations are using. And I found out that indoor growing industry in this country so far last year has used 1.3 terawatts. That's 1 terawatt is equal to 1 million gigawatts. 1 gigawatt is equal to 1 million kilowatt hours worth of power. Now, we own and operate 12 acres of solar farm, which produces about 3 million kilowatt hours worth of power, supports 600 homes, and 5,000 square foot indoor growing operation is expected to use 3 million kilowatt hours worth of power every year.
Nalto, I'm going to leave it there. And before we even get an answer, I see we have another caller with an environmental impact question. So let me take that person too, and then we'll get answers to both. Michael in Boulder, Colorado, you're on Ask a Legal State. Hi, Michael.
Hi. And indeed, this is a major issue and of major concern of the 600 or so grows in the city of Denver. There's almost no use of any alternative energy of any kind. The last statistic I saw is that 1 kilo of marijuana is the carbon footprint or the carbon production equivalent of 11 trips coast to coast in a 44 mile per gallon automobile. The numbers are through the roof. It represents 4% of the entire energy drain of the city of Denver, which is trying to go in the opposite direction. And we're finding an industry with no energy czars or seemingly any internal regulation at all, with a major carbon footprint and an industry that seems to be profiteering off of the environment.
And Michael, I'm going to leave it there for time, but start to answer both of these callers' questions. Anne-Marie, for you as a reporter on this topic at Colorado Public Radio, and Michael's in Boulder, maybe people in non-legal states have an impression that when legalization comes, it's fields of green in agricultural areas. disabuse us of that notion.
Yeah, so it's no green waves of green. It's actually a lot more like a very bright room with lots of grow lights and lots of really loud whirring fans. Most weed cultivation happens indoors. I mean, Denver is obviously a great example, but a lot of the places where you see legalization happening, like in these big major metro areas, there are a lot of these indoor grow operations. And that caller was exactly right. He actually stole my statistic. 4% of the electricity in Denver is taken up by marijuana cultivation. But right now, the way that the regulations are written statewide, there's not an incentive really for this to be a greener industry. There is a lot of compliance that these businesses have to worry about. But then when it comes to sort of the environmental compliance, there isn't a ton. And I think another issue, too, is the way that the law is currently written is you know, for example, people in legal states are probably very familiar with these little plastic pop containers that you get your weed products in. That is because our state, and I know a few other states have done this, where they have mandated that really the only requirement with the packaging is that it has to be childproof. And the easiest thing to childproof is plastic. So you see the marijuana industry just generating loads and loads and loads of plastic. So it is a growing problem. But I'm going to, you know, say what Mark said earlier about a different topic, is that there's not really an answer to it yet.
The good news, I think, is this is a transitional problem. In Washington, what's called sun-grown, outdoor-grown, or at least greenhouse-grown, is the rising share of the market. It's much cheaper. It's much more environmentally friendly. It requires less pesticide. It requires less water. And, of course, much less power. And it's net about half the cost. So the bad news is that sun-grown is going to bring down the price, which I worry about unless we get appropriate taxation in. The good news is I think it's the way of the future. And again, if we were to nationalize legally, nobody would be renting space in Denver for a farm. It'd grow in Iowa.
That's
where it
true.
Belongs.
I think we've talked about this a lot. Our environmental reporter is actually doing something about this for our podcast. But yeah, we've talked about this a lot about... it's something like if we federally legalize, some people believe that most pot cultivation will happen on like a small number of farms in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, John Calkins has done the estimate.
Yes.
He could grow all of the cannabis consumed in the U.S. on 44,000 acres.
In other words, it would become like lettuce and tomatoes. Most
right.
of it would get grown in California and a few other places and shipped around the country. Now, because it's a state-by-state basis and the federal government doesn't sanction it, it has to be done in these
exactly.
massive indoor grow farms in each state to be sold only in that state.
Exactly.
Fascinating. And on that point, we end our part of the conversation with Mark Kleiman, professor of public policy at New York University and author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. He was also a consultant to the state of Washington in its legalization process. Mark, thank you for your contributions.
Thanks very much.
As Ask a Legal State continues.